Hello, and welcome to this episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real-World Perspectives. My name is Diana Isaacs, and I'm with my co-host, Natalie Bellini, and we have a very special episode where we are once again live at ADA Scientific Sessions in San Diego, California, and we have actually two of my wonderful colleagues here, Dr. Paloma Rodriguez and Dr. Kevin Pantalone. So if you two wouldn't mind introducing yourselves, maybe we'll start with ladies first. We'll start with Paloma.
Okay. Well, my name is Paloma Rodriguez. I am a diabetologist. I'm originally from Chile, and I've been working as a research fellow at the Cleveland Clinic in endocrinology and metabolism research.
Kevin Pantalone. I serve as a director of diabetes initiatives for the Department of Endocrinology, and I'm an active clinical researcher as well as still enjoy seeing patients.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being here. And I know you guys presented the transition T2D study there at ADA. So, Paloma, if you wouldn't mind sharing a little bit about what that trial is and what you presented here.
Sure. It was a randomized controlled trial looking to test the ability of semaglutide, 1 milligram, to replace the need for real-time insulin in patients, in type 2 patients already on MDI and already like pretty well controlled with an A1C of 7.5% or less. We include patients taking MDI up to multiple daily injections up to 120 units of insulin per day. And our limit for prandial insulin was 0.5 units per kilogram per day. All patients were adults, 18 to 75 years old. And they had to be on multiple daily injections for at least 6 months. And we allowed metformin or SGLT2 inhibitors as background therapy.
Before you point to the result, I'm just curious, where did this idea even come from? Right?
Because these people are kind of young people. We're in great control. Why would you make it that way? I mean, they're doing okay.
What? Tell us about that. Where did this idea come from?
Shortly after I graduated from fellowship, we started to have more GLP-1 receptor agonist therapy become available, particularly liraglutide, that's once daily. And I had one patient in particular who had came to see me. His A1C was 14%, and we got his A1C down to control. And at his follow-up visit, he said to me, you know, I can't do this the rest of my life. You know, the thought of injecting insulin 4 times a day for the next, you know, 40 years is just something I can't wrap my head around. And I said, well, you know, let's put you on liraglutide and see how you do. And at that point, I hadn't stopped his real-time insulin, but he came back to see me a month later, and I observed he was a very meticulous patient. He would write down all of his insulin doses, all of his liraglutide doses, and the last 3 days in his logbook before our visit, there was no Novolog docking. I said, you know, what happened here? Did you not take it? He said, oh, I went camping, and I forgot it, so I only brought my long-acting insulin and my liraglutide. And I said, did you notice that your blood sugars were exactly the same, whether you took the insulin or not? And he's like, wow, no, I didn't notice that. So it became very clear that in patients who are very well controlled on insulin injections, that once you get that to a target area, you know, an A1C reasonable control of less than or equal to 7.5%, that you can stop that prandial insulin and maintain that glycemic control, leverage a GLP-1 receptor agonist. And once they became once weekly, you know, we said, we've got to do this study. We were out to show the diabetes community that once patients are on insulin and they're well controlled, you can transition them to less intense regimen that may not only further improve their blood sugar, may also help them lose weight, but also really decrease the burden of management. You know, because I think sometimes as physicians, we don't really appreciate and recognize the burden that it puts on patients to have to take 4 injections of the day and to have to take insulin out in public when they're out to dinner with their spouse. And so anything we can do to de-intensify that burden of management for our patients, such as, you know, leveraging GLP-1 like we did in the transition study, I think is extremely important.
Wow. And also we know that patients that on MDI that are well controlled are many times well controlled because they are having lows and they like that A1C is an average. So right, we really seeing that we're getting them off a medication that causes hypoglycemia and causes weight gain, and putting them on a medication that does not cause hypoglycemia and causes weight loss is way like.
And that's why I have that cardiovascular risk reduction, right? I mean, it's like a triple whammy. You took away a lot of disease management burden on a daily basis. So can you talk a little bit about how many people did you recruit, first of all?
It was 60 patients.
Wow, okay.
So we randomized 2-to-1. So 40 patients were on the semaglutide group, and 20 patients continued to take multiple daily injections of insulin. Our population was like a classic type 2 patient on MDI. Like the median age was 68 years old. The median self-reported duration of diabetes was 18.5 years. And 85% of them had hypertension. 83% of them had dyslipidemia. So it was like the classic patient.
Right.
And our median BMI at baseline was 35.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Textbook, right?
Textbook, right. And so... then the intervention was like for the semaglutide arm, once they were randomized and once they started the semaglutide 0.25 milligrams, that same day they stopped the insulins.
Oh, okay. So right away, you didn't titrate, you didn't have a difficult, it was just stop it, here we go.
We wanted it to be very real world.
Yes.
A lot of those other studies that have looked at similar concepts, they always have a run-in period where they're titrating the insulin, we get the patients to controls, and then when they start a GLP-1, they cut the insulin in half. And we just know the barriers of routine clinical practice where it's very challenging to make those kinds of interventions and changes on a frequent basis. So. That was really important to us with the trial design, was to do something that doctors could do in the clinical setting, very simple. Stop your real-time insulin, you start your GLP-1, we'll reassess in 3 months, we're gonna titrate the GLP-1, you know, every month according to its label, and hopefully continue to maintain your current level of control, if not further improve, but also perhaps assist with weight loss while also reducing the burden of management. So, you know, your point about the CV risk reduction, you know, that's just yet on top of the benefit we've demonstrated in all those other areas.
Wow.
Because we know also that when patients with type 2 diabetes are prescribed to start multiple daily injections, it's very unlikely that someone is going to de-intensify.
Yeah, I'll do that, right.
And being able to demonstrate that it's safe to do it like in a one-step approach was really like very important to us.
It was also one of the concepts that really kind of helped evolve this project, that patient experience that I told you about, the gentleman who had missed his insulin shots over the weekend, was historically when we treat patients with diabetes, we're walking them from left to right. They're diagnosed, we add an oral drug, we add another drug, they start checking their sugar, we add basal insulin, then we add pre-insulin, and they're checking their blood sugar more, and they're giving more injections. Whereas here, this trial really allowed us the opportunity to finally walk the patients backward.
Right.
You're taking patients from 4 injections a day to 1. You're helping that patient lose weight. You're helping that patient reduce their burden of management. And they actually see that they're getting better with less injections and less the need for less blood sugar checks. So it's very empowering. I mean, these people really, not just looking at their A1C and their weight to these clinical outcomes, but just from the patient's perspective of finally seeing things move the opposite direction that they had been moving for so long was really, really empowering and was really great to see.
Wow, this is incredible. So tell me how many people dropped out and why did you have, and was it GI issues? Was it?
Well, I just want to know what the results were.
Right, yeah, okay. No, wait, I can't get to like the dropouts and stuff, yeah.
Well, our main outcome was to compare the percentage of patients that maintained an A1C of 7.5 or less at 26. And there was no difference. So we were able to demonstrate that both interventions were effective to maintain the patients on a reasonably well-controlled level. So, and then for our secondary endpoints, we saw a decrease in the A1C of 0.5% for the semaglutide group. So these patients started with an A1C, a median A1C of 6.8, and we were able to decrease it further to 6.3. The multiple daily, the control group did not experience any change in their mean A1C. And then for insulin doses, we at week 26, the total daily dose of insulin decreased in the semaglutide group by 56% and increased in multiple daily injection. So the difference between the mean difference between both groups was like 63% of insulin difference between both groups. So 97.5% of our patients were able to totally replace real-time insulin without needing to reintroduce it at week 26. And prandial, we not only were able to decrease prandial insulin by almost 100% because there's only one patient that needed to reseal it, but we also saw a 20% decrease in basal insulin in this group. So,
and five patients came off basal insulin entirely.
Exactly. So they had
unbelievable. They went from four injections a day to just
one a
week for eight. Wow.
And the only patient that needed to resume real-time insulin was because she had an adverse event and she could not continue to take. So at week 12, we needed to stop the semaglutide.
Okay.
And she had to resume real-time insulin. But from among the patients that were able to continue semaglutide, none of them needed to resume real-time insulin. Even though we had four patients that were not able to go to the full one milligram dose.
Right.
So even though they stayed on 0.5, they were still able.
We're still able to get the result, right? Uh-huh. It's an interesting hormone, in general, the class, that GLP-1 class where, some people, 0.25 is a lot, right? Some people, 0.5, they don't even know they got it. And then some people, one is the wallop, and then some it's two, right? And they can tolerate different levels, and you can't pick them. That's the interesting part. It's not like I can look at you and say, you'll never be able to take more than 0.2 versus you that could take, 2.4, right? We don't, you can't always predict that. But I love the fact that you could just leave them where they were and still get that same outcome, This is phenomenal.
Don't forget about the weight data.
Oh, yeah. Wait, yeah, the weight data was impressive. We had 8.9 kilograms decrease, like in actual weight. I'm sorry, into kilograms.
That's okay.
That's okay. Don't multiply by 20.
But you know, it's 8.6% reduction in weight.
Wow.
So, and this is semaglutide 1 milligram. If we're at the 2 milligram dose, it's not, and this is patients with type 2 diabetes that we know that in clinical trials don't have the same weight loss response as people with obesity, with non-diabetes. So, this was better than anything that has been reported for the 1 milligram.
What happened to the control group? Did they gain weight or?
They gained a little bit, like 1.4% of body weight increase at 26 weeks.
And also the safety, right? And these MDI type 2 slowly over time, it's like a pound or two or three or four a year, but you're doing that for 20 years and now you've got obesity on top of obesity. This is incredible data.
I mean, this was a 26-week trial. Right. And to further summarize, nearly 50%, I think it was actually 45%, 45% of the patients who switched to semaglutide from prandial with sun lost greater than 10% of their body.
Wow.
So it really highlights when you stop a medication that drives weight gain,
right,
an anabolic, and take that away and replace it with one that's orexigenic, like helping the patient lose weight, it really was a dramatic sway in weight within a very short period of time. And I think many of these patients, some went on to higher doses and continued therapy after the study. We saw even further weight loss.
Okay.
As we've seen in a lot of the GLP-1 studies that have been released, you get that initial drop, but then a lot of times, with further use, we see continued weight loss.
We see that later.
I think some listeners might be wondering why just the 1 milligram dose, but my understanding is that when you started the clinical trial, that was the highest dose for diabetes, and then later on the 2 milligram.
But it highlights that you didn't need the 2 milligram high dose to get great results.
It's an incredible outcome.
And so, the 2 milligram dose may have made the weight loss even more pronounced, or the A1C reductions even more pronounced. But the fact that only one out of those 40 patients randomized to semaglutide had to resume prandial insulin tells you that, you know, the therapy is very effective even at the lower doses.
Yeah. Wow. It's incredible. It really is. Right. So how do you think this is going to impact patient care, the results of the study?
I think that MDI in type 2 diabetes patients is starting to, like, there should not, I mean, nobody should be starting multiple daily injections currently in a patient in type 2 diabetes, handle all this, that when they can use all these new medications. And that population that is already on MDI, that's our goal, to just like give them also the opportunity to get all the benefits from this. So basically we have like we can tell the clinicians that it's very safe and effective to, whenever you have a patient that is relatively well controlled on MDI on less than 120 units per day, you can safely transition them in one step. And so I think it's big, like if for primary care, for all the non-specialists that manage these patients, being able to de-escalate in therapists.
I mean, there is unfortunately a large population of patients that are still out there on MDI, are reasonably well controlled or even maybe slightly above that 7% goal. And, you know, they initiated prandial insulin because they didn't have GLP-1 available back then. Or, you know, their provider put them on insulin and then didn't feel comfortable trying to get them off. And so it really is up to us to show through this type of study that yes, it's effective, but also too, it's very safe and you can do it in a very practical manner. So don't relegate your patients to continue with insulin therapy long-term, particularly mealtime insulin, because many of them probably don't need it, especially those that are under control.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it further reinforces using GLP-1s, definitely before mealtime insulin, and really is the first injectable, like Amy Aik says. But also, you're right, there's so many people that are on MDI for various reasons. And I think there's a lot of confusion, or people are nervous. How do I transition them? Is it going to take so many steps? And you've essentially proven you could do it in one.
Right.
Don't do any of that. That's really it.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, patients that have been living with diabetes for over 20 years. And it's like, because I think one of the greatest fears is like probably their beta cell function is not, it's gone. So probably they're not going to be able to secrete their own insulin in order to cover their meals. But yes, they are.
The average duration of diabetes of both groups is around 18 years.
Yeah.
So I think it really highlights that GLP-1 receptor agonist therapy, we have clear data that shows that it's very effective in the early, newly diagnosed patients. But there's a lot of data out there, long-standing diabetes patients.
Hey.
Don't assume that there's no beta cell function. You need to put that patient on a GLP-1, harvest that beta cell function, get that insulin secretion, suppress that glucagon. And on top of that, when you suppress satiety, eat less, you don't require as much insulin to control your
blood
sugar. So, you know, it all really works together to really help reduce the burden of management.
The secretions. We even had one of the patients that, and because we had two patients that were not, that we had to stop semaglutide.
Okay.
And only one of them received mealtime insulin. The other patient had lost weight, and she really didn't need to receive insulin.
Right.
So,
I think one of the key take-home points I'd like to make is that you don't need to continue the insulin, the prandial insulin.
Right.
Like, I see a lot of times when I have patients who are uncontrolled, they come to me, and I add a GLP-1 to their regimen, and they come back, and their blood sugars look great, they're low. The easy thing to do is say, oh, well, we'll just keep doing what you're doing. But actually, I will continue to lower the insulin, and what you'll see is that you'll lower their prandial insulin doses, and their blood sugar control doesn't change.
Right.
So the only thing you're doing by continuing that prandial insulin to those patients is suppressing their own body's response to the GLP-1 that they're receiving.
Right.
So you won't see that until you withdraw the insulin injections. to clearly show that you don't need.
I'm also thinking of the applications potentially on hypoglycemia and time in range, which I know wasn't routinely looked at for each person, but it probably was a reduction in hypoglycemia too by reducing all that mealtime insulin.
Well, we measured hypoglycemia, not with CGM data, so it was self-reported hypoglycemia, but we didn't see a decrease in the rates of hypoglycemia at each time point, but it did not reach the statistically
right.
So first, that was not the main outcome.
The main interest in that observation to look at, right? Yep.
And also, we saw that many of those hypoglycemic events were clustered in the semaglutide group in some patients that had like great glycemic response to the drug.
Right, well, that super responder where you get that first injection and it's like, wait a minute, what just happened to me, right? Yeah, and we don't understand that either. Some people respond right away at that lowest dose and, right, yeah.
And there's even a variable degree of response within the class.
Yes.
You put patients on drug A and you don't see much improvement. You put it on a different GLP-1 and all of a sudden you're like, you know, you wouldn't expect
right.
There's just so much heterogeneity, and I think it's really important for the viewers to just recognize that if you really want to assess the response to GLP-1, you really got to just try it.
Yep.
And I tell that to the patients, look, you know, maybe you're a little apprehensive about the injection. Let's give it 3 or 4 months. If you're not happy with the direction things are heading, we'll stop it and try something else. Once you get to the 3 or 4 month time point, they're doing so well. They're feeling better. They finally are able to start losing weight after years of not being able to. They're seeing their blood sugar control improve. Nobody wants to move them.
Right. I agree. I absolutely agree. So were there any, I have one curious question. What about, did you do either depression scores or patient satisfaction scores, or can you talk a little bit about that at all? Because as a person thinking about this as a clinician, I'm going to, how do you feel? What is it like? I mean, have I empowered you, right? So can you talk a little bit about the patient development?
Yes, we did treatment satisfaction, the diabetes treatment satisfaction questionnaire. And we saw an improvement in treatment satisfaction in both groups.
Okay.
And it did not reach significance between groups. So both groups increase their satisfaction. And what we think is that first, both groups actually had a new treatment started.
Right.
Because patients were on MDI and we switched them. Most of them were either on once or twice daily glargine or twice daily detemir. So we switched them to degludec.
Okay.
And we switched the whatever mealtime insulin they were taking, we switched it to aspirin. So that was one thing. Most patients felt that degludec was a better insulin than what they were doing in the first place. So second, the questionnaire explores other areas of treatment, like how frequently you feel that your blood sugars have been higher or lower. How satisfied are you with your current knowledge about your diabetes? And all of those things were addressed in the clinical visit,
right?
With both arms. So we educate them about diabetes, the patients on MDI, about like pre-bolusing, all those stuff. So I believe that most of them felt, unfortunately, we don't have CGM data, but I think that probably most patients on MDI were having less hypoglycemia
right.
at the end of the study. Also, when you go to a clinical trial, you have like a 1 hour
yes.
long duration. Exactly. And you have the cell phone
right.
number of the
right.
coordinator, and you can reach them out in case you need anything or you're unsure about how to titrate and everything. So I believe that we were expecting, honestly, to see like greater satisfaction in the semaglutide group. But we are happy with having greater satisfaction than the baseline, but not
very difference between groups. Right. Sometimes the survey tools just aren't accepted.
Yeah, I mean, that's the challenge is that the people that stayed on MDI got more attention than they've gotten, right?
Yeah.
Even though you see your patients, I'm not questioning your quality of care, right? It's just that they're seeing more, they're talked to more than they are in their usual care method. And people like that, right? They like that touch base. So it's not surprising, you know, that it didn't, we always need a different kind of study, right? Or a different kind of questionnaire to drill down a little bit better.
Probably more focused on the specific drug therapy rather than
quality
diabetes care, which is multifactorial.
Exactly, right.
Well, thank you so much, Wilma and Kevin, for joining us to talk out about the study. And thanks so much to everyone for tuning in to this episode of Diabetes Dialogue.